Hi, this is Ruth McCauley with news from the Decatur area for Thursday, August 11th. We begin with some articles in the Decatur Herald and Review. This on the front page and written by Valerie Wells, an H&R staff writer. Summer maintenance. Summer is always a busy time in the Decatur School District's buildings and grounds departments. Some tasks just can't be completed when buildings are occupied, such as the deep cleaning that custodians have been engaged in, which means classrooms are emptied, every stick of furniture is wiped down, and every inch of the rooms is cleaned and polished. There's no summer break for this department. The big project is the Dennis School driveway improvement, said Jim Gortner, the new director of buildings and grounds, who took over after Mike Sartoroff's retirement. We're creating a one-way route from Main to Wood. That has been a safety issue for many years. Traffic circulation in the Dennis parking lot was terrible during drop-off and pickup times. We don't lose any parking spaces, but the student safety is going to be much better. The new drive meant the playground equipment had to be moved, but now the congestion in the parking lot will be relieved. Buses will have a separate area for drop-off and pickup. While Dennis is one of a few neighborhood schools remaining, the majority of students come to school on a bus or with parents rather than on foot or by bicycle, as was the case at one time. The project will be finished in time for school to start August 17th. Wow, that's around the corner. The district is able to do several large projects this year that require hiring outside contractors, thanks to the additional revenue provided by the 1% sales tax increase approved in 2010, Gortner said. Those funds finance the bonds issued by the district to pay for the renovations of Eisenhower and MacArthur High Schools also, and amount to around $1 million a year. Mike Sartoroff didn't have that luxury, Gortner said. With those funds, the district has been able to move some long-term projects forward, such as roof replacements that Sartoroff had planned to spread out over several years. This summer's schedule of work, besides Dennis's driveway, has included repaving the parking lot at the Professional Development Institute, renovating the baseball field at Baum School to provide Thomas Jefferson Middle School's teams a place to play, partial roof replacement and asbestos abatement at Enterprise School, repaving the alley at French Academy, repaving the West Playground at Franklin School, replacing the sanitary sewer system and installing a new boiler system at Harris School, repaving the parking lot at Southeast School, masonry repairs and replacing the track at MacArthur, and demolishing the concrete bleachers at Piggott Field, and finally demolishing Washington School. All the masonry surfaces on the MacArthur building are being completely tuck pointed and new mortar put in, Gortner said. That's a big job. At the time MacArthur was undergoing remodeling, the tuck pointing didn't fit into the budget, he said, and had to be put off until a later time. At the Professional Development Center, the recycling center that once operated on Saragordo Street has long since closed, and the district has torn it down and is resurfacing that lot to create more parking for the center. A lot of training sessions take place there, and more parking was needed. In the courtyard at Harris, teachers and students have been working on a garden area with paths to allow students to learn about growing things, but it was discovered that the sewer system was clogged beyond the point of fixing it, and the entire system had to be replaced, Gortner said. That meant the courtyard had to be torn up and the project will have to start over again from scratch. At least we got to it before they'd done all that work, he said. One of the biggest projects was the demolition of Washington School, adjacent to Johns Hill Magnet School. The district began a process to consider building utilization district-wide, and one of the buildings most in need is Johns Hill due to its age. The FACES, Facility Advisory Committee for Exceptional Schools Committee, held a couple of community meetings to gather input from stakeholders, but its work has been suspended for the time being and no decisions have been made. One of the suggestions was to add or rebuild John's Hill at its present location because families and staff expressed a deep affection for the hill. And if that should be the ultimate decision, the space where Washington was would be needed. And even if that isn't the ultimate decision, the building was old and too expensive to repair and to bring up to school code, Gortner said. I don't like having an empty building sitting around, he said. We had to have the police out there a lot because of people breaking in. More about getting ready for the opening of school inside on the local section of the Decatur Herald and Review. Another article written by Valerie Wells. Schools hear a leadership message. In the spirit of Jeff Foxworthy's You Might Be a Redneck If routine, author and comedian Tim Clue handed out cards to his audience of school administrators Wednesday and asked them to read aloud. You know you're a school administrator when you snap your fingers at kids you don't even know and say, "Where are you supposed to be?" read Matt Andrews, principal of Dennis School, laughing. The Macon Piatt Regional Office of Education and the Education Coalition of Macon County's annual back-to-school breakfast for principals and district administrators is a good place to network and a good way to kick off the new school year on a note of cooperation and community, said Jill Reedy, Assistant Regional Superintendent. Though Clue's presentation was filled with laughter and audience participation, his message was a serious one. You have to change the school culture to adapt to what students need most, he said. By creation, trust, connection, and a team in the classroom, I think that should be by creating. By creating trust, connection, and a team in the classroom, he said, kids will be engaged and learning becomes an experience instead of just absorbing information. He talked about a friend who does education research and has at his disposal all tools and rubrics you could ever want for measuring student learning. But his bottom line is simple. Kids who are learning are focused on the teacher. He told me, I look at the eyeballs, Clue said. You don't need studies to tell you who's getting it and who needs more. You just need your gut. Nobody can retain what they hear in more than 8-minute increments of lecture, he said. So teachers need to know when they can't talk longer than that without engaging the students' participation somehow. He also asked how many districts had lost talented teachers in the last few years. All of them raised their hands, and some exchanged glances with each other as they did so. Do you want to keep teachers? Here's what they want, Clue said. Control, community, and cash. They don't need all three. They just need one. Talented teachers are challenging, he said. They push the boundaries. They have ideas that might not work, yet it's those teachers who change lives. I thought the presentation was a good way to remind us of what's important, said Henry Walker, principal of Hope Academy in Decatur. We always get pretty focused on the academics, raising the achievement in many ways. We also need to be reminded that as far as with students and staff, we need to keep in mind that we need to look at them as people, as a person that's capable of carrying that task out. As administrators, we're tasked with leading the charge, but in my philosophy, we're leaders of leaders, whether it's students or staff. Randy Thacker from Mount Zion Schools said that the new school year has been on educators' minds for weeks already. Now we're seeing the reality of it, and it's good for us to think positively and get ready for the staff to come in, he said. Our next article carries was written by Allison Petty, H&R staff writer, and carries the headline, Get Up Close to Scoville Animals at Zoorific Evening. Need a pirate ship for your fundraising event, but can't find someone to build one? That's what family is for. Brandy Brown found out as much as she led the committee charged with planning this year's Zoorific Evening, an annual adults-only party that benefits Scoville Zoo. The theme is an evening in Key West, and one idea for an auction item was a playhouse resembling a pirate ship. Brown rounded up plans and a sponsor, First Mid-Illinois Bank and Trust, to pay for materials, but she couldn't find anyone to put the ship together. So she enlisted her family, including her husband, son, brother-in-law, and two sons-in-law. It definitely took the entire village, he said. The girls all provided food and held boards, and it worked out great. The result of their labors are on display at the zoo, where the event will be held Saturday, August 27th, starting at 5 p.m. Features include tropical food and beverage stations, street performances, a photo booth, and an auction at which the pirate ship will find a new home. Eight local restaurants will provide the food: Beach House, Bazoo, Country Club of Decatur, Dell's Popcorn Shop, Gin Mill, Salsa American Burrito Company, Taproot, Texas Roadhouse, and The Wharf. Of course, one major attraction is the chance to interact with animals, and each animal encounter also offers a raffle ticket for door prizes. Brown said the evening will also include a presentation of butterflies from the collection of Dr. William Barnes, one of the founders of Decatur Memorial Hospital. The hospital obtained the collection from the Smithsonian in honor of its 100th anniversary. Past Zoorific evenings were targeted to raise money for the Humboldt Penguin exhibit, which opened in 2013. River otters are the next addition in the long-term plan, but there's quite a bit of infrastructure work needed before they can come to Decatur. It takes a ton of money, Brown said. I don't think people sometimes realize that it's millions of dollars to even create the place. It's not the animals that are so expensive. It's the stuff you need to put them in. Tickets for the Zoorific Evening are $75. They can be purchased by calling 217-422-5911 or 217-421-7435 or by visiting decatur-parks.org online. We have a crime and courts piece written by Tony Reed, H&R staff writer. This with the headline, Police Report Anger Issues in Use of Gun. A Decatur man with anger issues, who doesn't like people looking at him, threatened a married couple, described as his friends, by firing a bullet into the ground outside their home, according to police. Sworn statement said Telly C. Young, out walking a pit bull dog, had approached the couple on the afternoon of July 10th in the 800 block of South Illinois Street. The wife told police he had yelled out, "What the explicative are you looking at?" and retrieved a dark-colored handgun, firing a single shot into the yard in front of her residence. Police said the couple fled inside their house, and patrol officers later recovered a single spent 9mm bullet casing from the sidewalk outside the house. Officers didn't find Young at that time, but said they caught up with the 39-year-old suspect Monday night and arrested him after a foot chase. Police said Young was, quote, belligerent, making profane and sexually lewd comments to officers, end quote, while he was being taken into custody. He was jailed on preliminary charges of reckless discharge of a firearm, possession of a weapon by a felon, and resisting a peace officer. The couple, who allegedly were threatened in the gun incident outside their home, told police they knew Young and described him as a friend with anger issues who was dealing with the recent loss of family members. Police said Young has previous convictions for firearms offenses and has served several prison terms. He was on parole the day he allegedly fired the handgun. No bond was available for Young, and he was in the Macon County Jail on Tuesday night. He is due in court September 9th. I'm turning over to the Decatur Tribune and picking up Paul Osborne's City Beat column. It looks like there's an interesting article here. Grow Decatur survey data interesting. Thanks to Larry Altenbalmer, Bruce Nims, and Ellen Hearn for sitting down with me and updating what's been happening with the Grow Decatur group in their efforts to, as the name indicates, grow Decatur. What I found especially interesting was a survey that was collected online by solicitation of voluntary subjects drawn from the general population of the Decatur area during April of this year. A net sample involved 567 subjects. The breakdown was female 67.2%, male 32.8%, white 76.4%, and black African American 16.3%. According to the survey results, more than 70% of the participants were positive about living in the Decatur area, and less than 16% of the total surveyed were negative. With all the whining and complaining about Decatur that we read and hear these days, it would almost seem that those percentages should be reversed. I guess that shows you that a small number of dissatisfied residents are making all of the negative noise. One other aspect of the survey data that I found especially telling was that residents age 18 to 22 are, quote, significantly more negative about Decatur than the average participants, and that young women are more negative than men of the same age group. By the age of 30, people are generally satisfied. Of course, the survey included 567 subjects, so out of the much larger population, attitudes about our city are subject to debate. My viewpoint column on page 3 of this week's print edition of the Decatur Tribune deals with a critical aspect of what Grow Decatur has found in their efforts to define problem areas and work on a plan to resolve those problems. We turn back to the front page of the Herald and Review and pick up an article written by Justin Kahn, an H&R staff writer. In sickness and in health, wife donates kidney to help ailing husband. Malcolm Beasley will never forget the moment his wife, Iris Lewis Beasley, told him she was planning on giving him one of her kidneys. Both of the 39-year-old Beasley's kidneys were failing, and he needed a transplant. He was on dialysis 3 days a week for 4 hours a day to keep him alive. The Beasleys had been told by Springfield Memorial Medical Center's transplant services team that a kidney from a blood relative would work best. Malcolm's family put out text and Facebook blasts asking relatives to be tested as possible donors, but donating a kidney isn't an easy life decision. It's a burden, both giving up a kidney and financially, because it's a lot of time not working, Iris said. I honestly wasn't too optimistic. That's when Iris called Memorial and asked them to test her. It turned out their blood types were a match. At that point, Iris told Malcolm she was donating her kidney to him. I was just like, wow, sweetie, you don't have to do this, Malcolm said. But Iris pushed forward. Two more tests had to be done, tissue typing and serum cross match. I wasn't a perfect match, but close enough that they were willing to proceed, Iris said. On July 26th, Malcolm and Iris entered Memorial Medical Center with tears streaming down their faces and the faces of their children. It's emotional. I'm crying just thinking about it, Iris said the day before the surgery. There are certain things you don't have control over. We're optimistic. When you look at their success rate with the surgery, the odds are in our favor. But there can be complications with surgery. We can only pray everything works out like it should. 2 weeks after surgery, it's working. Malcolm, with one of Iris's kidneys now in his body, actually left the hospital before Iris, who had a minor complication. But both are home now and recovering. His body is accepting the kidney, Iris said. He has to take medicine that lowers his immune system so it doesn't attack his kidney and cause his body to reject it. But his creatinine levels, blood pressure, and urine output are normal and falling into place. He's doing extremely well. Pardon me. Malcolm and Iris were high school sweethearts. They began dating during their sophomore year in 1993. Iris got pregnant and had a baby while still in high school, but Kaylin died at 3 months old. Still, Malcolm and Iris stuck together. We've been through a lot. We're like Bonnie and Clyde, Malcolm said, laughing. We got in trouble together and we did everything together. Malcolm and Iris. It's like it's one word now. Malcolm and Iris have 3 children. Elena, 19, Malcolm Jr., 15, and Elijah, 2. Life was good in October 2015 when Malcolm told Iris he was having trouble with his vision. It was later in the week, and he told me, "Babe, I need some new glasses," and said he was going to make an appointment soon, Iris said. But then that weekend, it kept getting worse and worse, and on Monday, he called me from work and said it was so bad he couldn't even see the numbers on his cell phone. Iris took Malcolm to Central Illinois Vision Center in Decatur, where bleeding and swelling was found in Malcolm's retina. His blood pressure was 270 over 163, so Malcolm was immediately taken to the emergency room. Once admitted, he was put in the intensive care unit. They checked him and found out that his kidneys had failed, and he was put on dialysis, Iris said. Malcolm was diagnosed with IgA nephropathy, also known as Buerger's disease, which is a kidney disease caused when an antibody called immunoglobulin A, IgA, gets stuck in kidneys, causing inflammation that keeps kidneys from being able to filter blood. He'd had it for years and had no idea what was going on, Iris said. He was absolutely healthy. He worked out at the YMCA all the time, but the damage to his kidneys was advanced. He had less than 9% function. The process that led to Iris donating her kidney to Malcolm didn't exactly go smoothly. First, the hospital had to agree to do the surgery. An ethics committee met and said it was comfortable with the procedure. Then Malcolm and Iris had to decide if it was the right thing to do as parents. I'm a perfectly healthy person opting for an elective surgery. I never had any reservations, but there are a lot of I's to dot and T's to cross, Iris said. We had to consider genetics. Is this something that could be passed on to the kids? Because then I wouldn't have one I could donate to them. And we also had to consider the danger of having 2 parents on an operating table. What if something happened to one or both of us? We had to consider it, and we had to have things lined up just in case. Just to give Malcolm the kidney, Iris had to undergo surgery to have a mass removed from her bladder that turned out to be harmless. Then, just days before the surgery, Malcolm was let go as facility support manager at a bank, which left him without insurance. He didn't have any more FMLA, Family and Medical Leave Act time, Iris said. They said they had have the intention to hire him back when he recovers, but it left him without any coverage. Wow. Iris Iris was able to get Malcolm on her insurance through her employer, Accutech Systems, out of Muncie, Indiana, but the deductible is high. To help with expenses, Iris started a GoFundMe account, gofundme.com/BeasleyTransplant. The site has a picture of the Beasley family with a short description of their plight and updates post-surgery. So far, the site has raised $2,295. I was a little upset about it at first. It hurt my pride, Malcolm said, but I had to put my pride aside, and to see that people have donated, I'm forever in debt to them. Malcolm and Iris have had to get comfortable with accepting help. 2 nights before the surgery, several neighbors, including some they had never met, stopped by the Beasley's home to wish them luck and offer help. Their daughter, Elena, a criminal justice major at Ball State University, has taken time off from school to help. Iris's sister, Tracy, came from Tampa Bay, Florida, for the surgery. Elena has been carrying the brunt, but my older kids are very self-sufficient, Iris said. Having a 2-year-old makes things more complicated, but we have a great support system. This journey has had its challenges, but waiting time for organs is 3 to 5 years at best, so it was worth it to get to this point. There are still challenges ahead. The body can reject new organs for the first several months, but Malcolm is happy to be alive and never forgets who he has to thank for that. Every time someone hears our story, they cry. They think my wife is an angel, and she is, Malcolm said. Not too many people are trying to give you one of their kidneys. When you get married, they say, in sickness and in health. She went to bat for me. She's amazing. But that's just the type of person she is. She's always there for me and my kids. Here's a quick note in the briefs column for today. Food innovation finalists in the first Food Innovation Challenge are Vidalia Onion Relish, produced by Kathy's Kitchen in Virginia, Illinois, refrigerated cookie dough pieces by Susie's Doozies, LLC in Union, Missouri, and cupcakes by Sweet Freedom Gluten Free Baker in New Hampton, Iowa. The small businesses were called from 10 semifinalists and announced Wednesday during a news conference at Richland Community College. The final competition will be today, and placement of the three companies will be announced tonight during an awards banquet at the Decatur Club. Tickets are $50 and must be purchased in advance. Go to www.foodinnovationchallenge, all one word, .com/registration to buy online tickets. Proceeds benefit Mercy Kitchens, a culinary-based job training program at the Good Samaritan Inn. The contest is sponsored by Archer Daniels Midland Company and National Food Works Services. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be back with the second half hour of news from the Decatur area for Thursday, August 11th. Hang tight.